Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we have onions and...
Lawns.
What
else?
How about that?
They're always out there.
They are always out there, aren't they? Some onions are better than others, though. And the onions that we speak of today include the...
Ornamental
alliums. And Mark Madonna is going to join us.
Yeah, once again, I was reading Horticulture Magazine, one of my favorites, and... there's this really wonderful article about a man named Mark McDonough who spent 30 years growing ornamental onions or alliums. Mm-hmm. And you and I both were surprised at the scale of what's out there. We both maybe plant the big globe masters and the purple ones in the spring and like those. This guy has got alliums that will grow spring, summer, and fall. Mm-hmm. He's grown thousands of them in his yard, and he's not for profit. He just does it for fun. He's an architect by trade. Interesting man. I've talked to him a couple of times already, and I think it's going to be very, very enlightening on what's possible in the allium field.
Yeah. Look forward to that, because, you know, I love my alliums.
I know.
That one spring, I spent, hours in the fall planting, 200 different, bulbs, yeah. A couple different varieties of alliums. And that spring, it was glorious.
And a lot of people don't plant alliums. They don't realize that there's mm-hmm. ornamental onions and there's edible onions in mm-hmm. there. Same family. But
yeah.
Two different things.
Yep.
And then, of course, we're going to talk about American green, the lawns, and how our obsession with it, which is going to be interesting because we are truly obsessed
with
lawns.
We really are. It's weird, and it wasn't always like that.
No.
Ted Steinberg, he's an environmental historian, recently penned a book called American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. And he looks at sort of the history and evolution of lawns, basically, in America. Back in the day, we didn't have... lawns. We had gardens or dirt.
And goats.
Our farm little animals were out front, or you'd have a cutting garden or your vegetable garden. Or if it was an urban setting, it was, a dusty street out front kind of thing.
The post-World War II boom was mm-hmm. part of what happened here, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden the lawnmowers became available, and then... Mm-hmm.
And with the Industrial Revolution, I think with some of the Americans that made a lot of money off of that, traveled to Europe, they wanted... the lawns that they saw around those great estates brought that kind of, how did it go from this elitist sort of thing to every man having a lawn?
Neighborhood having 25 lawn trucks out there.
Right, and post-war attitudes. And, so it's a very interesting story to say the least.
And what did we do on Saturday morning before we cut lawns?
Mm-hmm.
What did America do?
Yeah.
Milk the cow?
Exactly. Wasn't watching cartoons on TV.
Chase the chickens, whatever,
Exactly.
Pre-lawn America, coming up.
Indeed, pretty cool. Bob, in the meantime, what's going on in your garden these days?
Well, it's fun. Again, I've had a plan in mind since last fall, and it's coming together. I purchased what I call my perfume bottle. It's pretty. It's a deep blue, about 5 foot tall, one of those big... flask with a top on it,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a more... Yeah, I know it. I could do better than that. I could do more justice to it.
He had hand motions with that description that you didn't get to
see. Okay, here's the picture. I got a weeping Katsura tree.
Uh-huh.
Beneath that weeping Katsura, I opened a window, painted a bright red bench, which faces a blue perfume bottle, 5-6 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
behind which is a summer chocolate mimosa.
Cool.
She's that burgundy leaf.
Yeah.
And some of those paniculata hydrangeas.
Which are fabulous.
That turn pink and late, not used mm-hmm. enough at all.
No, they're not.
So that's going to turn pink, white to pink in late summer. So I got the summer chocolate, white to pink hydrangea, blue perfume bottle, red bench, weeping green Katsura.
Sounds fabulous.
And I did all this since last fall. And it's coming together.
Like you wanted it to.
It's come. So
it's crazy how that happens.
We're going to drag you out to see it.
Okay. You don't have to drag me.
Okay.
Is it maybe a genie bottle?
That's better than what I said.
Okay.
Yeah, I call it a perfume bottle. It's like a genie
bottle.
Since it's
really big, the genie could fit in it.
It's not a cork. It's got a round, a marble top.
Right.
But it really is coming together. And, of course, gardening is 3 years, as we know.
Right.
This year is the start. Next year is going to be okay. And the third year,
just a knockout.
Going to be tears running down my face.
What's
up?
Really nice.
What's up with the Wishy Estate?
I'm doing cleaning up spent debris. A good way to manage disease issues and insect issues for the season to come. In fact, you got to make sure you clean up and get rid of old debris.
Yeah.
So I've hauled out all the wilting, dying, anything in the vegetable garden that is no longer producing. Get rid of that. Same thing goes for your perennial garden. And if you notice that you have diseased stuff, whether it's powdery mildew or thrips will stunt plants. witch's broom types of things. You want to cut that away and get it out of the garden. And some plants, actually, you need to determine whether or not the disease is like a one that's like in the system.
Exactly.
Yeah. To where you need to dig it up and throw it out, because it'll just keep coming back. You know, Bob, one thing that's actually really easy to manage in the garden are allium, because once they're spent, they're actually still interesting kind of sculpturally in the garden. And then once they finally brown out, you just have to pull the stalk away.
Right.
It's, you know, you don't rip the bulb out, but it comes free easily. So perfect plant.
Perfect plant, and we got the perfect guest to talk about that. He's Mark McDonough. He's an architect by trade, but for the last 30 years has been designing and growing a garden in his Western Massachusetts home filled with thousands of allium, many which offer flowers and fragrance far beyond the traditional early spring alliums most of us grow. He also has an online site called Plant Buzz, isn't that neat, that includes his studies and work on alliums, hardy hibiscus, cleome, and rock gardening. Today he'll explain how all that began and how you can extend your ornamental onion growing season from spring until fall. Mark, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
First, a little background, please. We're curious, you know, exactly where you live and what kind of architectural work you do, and then what in the world got you going on alliums?
Well, I live sort of northwest of Boston, near the New Hampshire border, and I have worked as an architect for 17 years, but I have transitioned over to CAD management and IT management.
Okay. And what got you going on alliums? What was the genesis of that?
Well, I started gardening 40 years ago, or actually more than 40 years ago, mostly growing annuals, things like zinnias and snapdragons for my grandmother to pick. But, you know, like all things, things evolve, and my interest deepened, and I started growing wildflowers and perennials of all sorts. And it was a few years later where I came upon, I was in a nursery and came upon this this block of field-grown perennials, small little purple flower thing. It looked like grass, ornamental grass, but it was covered with little purple flowers.
Uh-huh.
And it ended up being a Chinese onion, and I was forever hooked.
Okay, and let's kind of begin with some clarification. You know, people think of onions and leeks and chives and garlic as food. Then, of course, there's the ornamental alliums or onions, too. Kind of differentiate between the two, or if there is a differentiation, and explain the difference.
Well, I think you bring up a good point, because there is quite this paradox or intrigue with the genus allium or onions, because they've been grown for thousands of years as a food crop, and you do know them from just five or six species that make up the onions, chives, leeks, garlic, and scallions. But then again, there are about 850 species throughout the entire northern hemisphere, and those you kind of typically refer to as the ornamental onions, and I think the genus has largely been overlooked through the centuries, and even currently is overlooked, and there's a lot of potential.
Oh, yeah. Now, what makes an allium, if that makes
any
sense?
Well, at one point, these used to be in the lily family, but when they started breaking down the lily family about 20 years ago, it became its own family. So there is an onion family now.
Okay.
And what really distinguishes alliums or onions is that they have a true bulb, unlike some things that have truly just rhizomes or corms or tubers or other forms of root structures. So the other thing is just the structure of the flowers is always six petals and six stamens and so forth. So those characteristics make up what an allium is, but I think people are familiar with a lot of the big purple globe type things that
right.
spring, which are those have been popular and increasingly popular these days.
Well, how far back in history do they go as an ornamental plant?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think they go back very far, because in the height of horticulture, there was a great deal of snobbery against alliums because they were thought to be stinky and the smell of onion. So if you look at some of the great works of by Reginald Farrar, who wrote one of the main volumes on rock gardening, for example, and there they shunned alliums as being these horribly stinky things that you wouldn't ever grow. So I think because of that, we're sort of catching up to the fact that, hey, these things actually look pretty good. They don't stink. Actually, a lot of them are very fragrant, actually,
right.
and are great bee and butterfly plants and good plants all around.
Yeah, I don't think they're stinky at all. I love them. I think about the walkway at Barnsley House, Rosemary Vary's garden in England, and all these, large alliums coming up above, basically a bed an allay of hostas and trees and stuff, and how beautiful it was. And I want to say it was on the front of one of her books. Can we talk a little bit about some of the more interesting varieties that are available? You know, the different species as well. And if we can also take into consideration that we're, you know, zone 6-7 for our Kentuckiana gardens.
Well, it's really intriguing how when you see these horticultural trends, how they sometimes, you know, they become such a strong trends that they lead you down a certain path and then you omit or forget about the other parts of the story. And this has certainly happened with all the popularity of these great big purple globes that you can dot your garden with. And they are fun, but they, you know, after June, they leave big holes in your garden.
Right.
You don't carefully plant them or intermingle them with other plants.
Right.
And they can be a little bit unsightly with the decaying foliage and so forth, but they're like true bulbs. They just disappear for the rest of the summer, and you have little other interest, unless you start using some of the other alliums. And the great predominance of alliums are actually summer blooming, and actually quite a respectable number are fall blooming. So you really can have a seasonal garden that goes from first thing in spring all the way through all the summer months, well up into fall and even early winter.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the only bulbous genus of plants that will actually carry you from all the way through every single spring, summer, and fall month in a northern or cold climate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd like to refer people to the horticulture article where I first came across your work and some beautiful pictures in there, really vibrant colors. Can you kind of walk us through the season, maybe what we could plant spring, summer, fall, and when to do the planting to get this parade of allium you're talking about?
Well, the alliums are pretty forgiving. You can plant them most any time if you have actual vegetative plants or bulbs. Seed you typically plant in the autumn or winter and allow it to stratify or take on some of the cold. And it would typically germinate in the spring. But right now, for example, one of our great unsung American alliums, of which there are about 140 species, is the, I call it prairie onion or Allium stellatum. And this plant blooms from July, depending on the form, from July, August, and many into September and October. In fact, they have many that are still just showing buds now.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So
and
here
what's
you
the
have
flower look like?
Pardon?
What's the flower look like?
The flower is starry. It's very similar to the nodding onion, if you're familiar with that, which is Allium ternuum.
Yes.
Except here on stellatum, the flowers turn sideways.
Huh.
So the dome of bloom looks sideways, which is kind of fun. And they'll have anywhere from 30 to 50 starry little blooms in shades of white to pink to deep rose. And they're very thin, so they can pop up out of nowhere, so to speak. And suddenly you've got these beautiful little dome, sideways domes of bloom waving in the breeze on stems typically about 2 feet tall. So that's a great summer bloomer that just takes you throughout the entire summer. And here it is, you know, a pretty much overlooked prairie plant.
Yeah, they are natives. I was surprised to read that a lot of them are natives and they've been here for a long time, even before us, perhaps, some of these plants.
Well, they have. In fact, there's a lot of documented use of allium, native allium species by native people and American Indians and, mm-hmm. and so forth, where, you know, the bulbs, you know, you think that the there's five or six species that are the edible types, but in fact, there was a research study showing that all allium bulbs are edible, although not all are palatable.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a
I was wondering
yeah.
about that. Is there any sort of medicinal value to any of the alliums?
There's certainly a lot of documented use for alliums for a variety of things besides actually eating and then, you know, mm-hmm. foraging and so forth. I'm perhaps not as up on that as I might be, as I've really mm-hmm. have focused almost entirely on their horticultural mm-hmm. Appeal.
So, since they do have a little bit of that traditional sort of onion quality, do pests sort of stay away from them, or could they potentially be a favorite chipmunk food?
That's an often suggested trick to plant alliums as a deterrent for both insects and animals and deer and so forth. I'm not sure how true that is or not.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what they are is an amazing attraction. I know that people sometimes struggle trying to develop a butterfly garden. Well, if you have a garden full of alliums, you just cannot believe the sound of just there's so many bees, butterflies, moths, and my particular favorite are these nectar-feeding wasps.
Yes, I like those.
These huge wasps, and they really just are entranced with the allium blooms.
Yeah, I'm again referring to Horticulture Magazine. There's one here, Allium Cernum, I think it is. I love the cosium in the spring. It's got a little white droplet on the end. This is a pink-flowered allium. It's just lovely, talented-looking thing here. And talk about that a little bit.
Well, again, that's another one of our native alliums that grows throughout most of not only most of America, but also up into Canada, where it's just it's found because it has such a wide distribution throughout most of the United States. It's quite variable in growth. So you'll find forms that are very small, some are very tall, some are showy and deep rose, others are pallid or pale and so forth. Yeah. And in the garden, they tend to hybridize amongst themselves, and they also hybridize with stellatum, the prairie onion, and even some of the Asian species. So you start getting these marvelous things happening in the garden. It's just no two are alike, and they're very, very fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk about that, because I think your garden is only about 60 by 80 feet, which isn't that big considering what you're doing. And you're getting new cultivars all the time. You're finding new plants. What do you do when you find them, and how do you find them?
Well, they do crop up. I find that since they are tiny little flowers, they're difficult to sort of hand pollinate. You could do this, but it would be extremely tedious. So I allow the bees to do the work. I quite often will pick a flower head or a pot of a plant and put it next to another one and allow the proximity of these two or three selected things provide the possibility for new hybrids. And the bees, because they are so attracted to the blooms, you get great seed crops from the alliums. And believe it or not, I'm not always good about deadheading, so some of my best hybrids have been self-sown seedlings that just appear in the garden path, and I didn't have the heart to dig them out. I want to see what they look like first.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So are they reliable in terms of coming back every year if they're, you know, the proper zone for the proper garden? You know, tulips have a reputation for needing to be replanted if you want something significant and bold every year. Are alliums going to regress or make progress over the years?
No, most of them are very, very easy, relatively easy to grow. In fact, they're soundly perennial. The only thing that they really insist upon, I mean, they are, for the most part, I think 95% of the species are sun worshippers. So
okay.
They like sun. There are some good shade ones, too, but they love sun. They like good drainage. You will lose them if you have a very wet, sodden soil, although there are a few that grow in swamps. But again, there's a lot of, for the most part, they are sun-loving, drainage-loving plants.
Mm-hmm.
So I admix a lot of sand into my soil. I also grow most of these in raised beds. I just sort of mound the soil up so that I don't have any water collecting in the winter when you can lose them sometimes. But you'll find that these things will grow on for years. In fact, I know I have some of my same plants that I had, you know, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Do they need to be divided often, or can you just kind of leave them be?
Well, there's two types of alliums for the most part, if we really simplify. There's the true bulbous type, and then there are those that they have bulbs, but they're attached to rhizomes, and they mm-hmm. call those the rhizomatous types. And those that have rhizomes are, you know, extremely long-lived and tough and drought-resistant, and they'll just survive anything. The bulbous types, sometimes, some of the little ones, for example, those that come from Turkey or the Mediterranean regions, tend to they'll cluster up so well that if they have a very, very dense cluster of bulbs, if they're 100 bulbs all tightly together,
mm-hmm.
they risk being rotting in the winter, where water kind of seeps in and keeps into the mass of bulbs. So if you divide those every now and then, you'll have a greater longevity of those types of bulbs. So
okay.
Those are a little bit more work sometimes because you can lose them. You have these great masses, and one year you've lost most of them because you had a whip.
Gotcha.
Well, Mark, you've got allium from Turkey, China, Norway, Israel, other parts of the world. Have you traveled there yourself, or how do you interconnect with other allium people?
Well, it used to be easier postal-wise, where you could share plants many years ago. Of course, that's mostly changed, where it's very secure now, so it's much harder. But there are seed exchanges if you belong to something like the North American Rock Garden Society or other plant societies where they have an annual seed exchange. And they may have as many as 60 varieties offered each year of various allium. The one difficulty is they are notoriously misnamed in cultivation because there's so few books on allium that I think people don't know how to reference them, so they just pass along the misidentifications.
That's your next job, huh?
So that's well, that is a that is a big job. There's only one popular book out there on allium, called The Ornamental Alliums by Dillis Davies, and that's been out for a good number of years now. But, you know, unlike things like daylilies and other groups of plants that are very well covered,
right?
The problem with allium is that's why it's there's so much intrigue with them, because there's just so little documented about them.
So isn't that a little bit of what you're doing on your Plant Buzz website, trying to catalog all the different alliums that you've come across?
Spread the word, yeah.
Well, I am. I'm particularly, some are notoriously misnamed, so I'm trying to shed a little light on what the proper identification is,
mm-hmm.
and also to show what the potential is for hybridization. I will soon post a new summer gallery of just these summer alliums and a lot of the hybrids. I've selected a good number of hybrids this year. I've been selecting for the last 7 years, haven't named any, and now I think this year I know which ones I think are the best,
mm-hmm.
and we'll get them into the hands of some other nurserymen, because I'm not a nurseryman myself.
Well, to that end, what nurseries would you recommend to have the most alliums, the best variety of alliums?
Well, you can get a lot of alliums that are the true bulbous types, and the number of those are increasing each year. If you go to a good garden center that has bulbs in the fall from Holland,
right,
you can get a good number there, and some new cultivars. But so far as the rhizomatous ones that I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and when I say that, you really have to think of these as garden perennials. They're not bulbs in the true sense. These things grow all season long, have good foliage all season long, and you can't dry the bulb and just send off a dry bulb. So you have to really buy it as a perennial that's potted. So it's a little difficult. There aren't many people offering these things. But what I have done is offered some plants to Plant the Lights Nursery, Tony Avent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's on a lot on our show, yeah.
Yeah, and he has three or four of my hybrids right now. And what I'm going to do is, after I do this new batch of hybrids next year, I'll probably send him 10 plants of each or something like that, and allow him to just go ahead and get them distributed. Because he's in the business of propagating. I am not, with limited resources. So that's probably the best bet to get them out there.
Yeah, he'd be a good one. Well, Mark, you sound like a happy camper, and we sure appreciate what you're doing and the way you're doing it. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Mark McDonough, an architect by trade, has spent the last 30 years growing and researching alliums in his Massachusetts garden. For more information on Mark or allium, visit the Homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, The Great American Lawn, Love It or Hate It. It has a history all its own. Environmental historian Ted Steinberg joins us for more after the break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill here.
And I think, Bob, if I could get away with it, I would have no lawn.
Well, you're close.
Yeah, well, not quite.
You got 20 acres of pasture.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're working on your meadow.
Yeah. But it's like I get annoyed. And I don't mean to be mean to all those lawn lovers out there, but I get annoyed that people want perfect lawns. It's like such a luxury. It's like the American fancy bathroom.
Yeah, in fact, I just did a column for the Courier about a particular subdivision in Louisville where some of the people were planting between the sidewalk and the road.
Uh-huh.
And others didn't like that because it screwed up the uniformity of the subdivision. And
they like people like that order, I guess, that the green blocks give.
Well, it's like you get in this, it's going to destroy the housing values thing. Yeah,
and
I love the little gardens they had.
Yeah.
That was
so
very nice.
Anyway, we're going to learn a little bit more about the history of our American obsession with green lawns and green expanses, et cetera. Ted Steinberg is joining us to talk about this subject. Ted is an environmental historian at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and the author of several books, including American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. He joins us today to talk about the history of the American lawn, a history that is sordid at times, perhaps, and how it is that this green expanse continues to be a growing American obsession. Ted, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Listen, first, why tackle, as an author, the history of American lawns? Where'd the idea come from?
Well, I mean, the lawn has been a part of my life since I was a little kid growing up on Long Island.
Sure.
But about 10 years ago, I moved to Shaker Heights, Ohio. I used to think of Long Island as the turfgrass capital of the world. But let me tell you, what's going on here in Shaker Heights, Ohio, is just simply not to be believed. The lawns of my neighbors don't just look like putting greens. They are putting greens. These people are planting creeping bent grass, the same species of grass that you'd find on a golf course, and they're putting down a lot of fungicide, tremendous amount of fungicide, water, of course. They're cutting it very, very low. So I began to think, well, you know, when I started to look into it, that the lawn is a much bigger deal than collectively than you probably realize. Mm-hmm. There are about 25 to 40 million acres of lawn here in the United States, and if you put all those little lawns together, you get an area either about the size of Kentucky or perhaps even as large as Florida. So it is a big issue. It's a $40 billion industry here in the United States, which is roughly the size of the gross domestic product of the nation of Vietnam.
Hmm. Wow.
So there's some, I guess there's like environmental implications in that. There's probably some political implications, certainly economic implications. But before we kind of delve back into that, the contemporary sort of obsessive reality we're in, let's step back and look at the way things used to be and how it came to be that we're so obsessed about these green expanses.
Well, I mean, going back in American history, I mean, people didn't pay all that much attention to vegetation, at least from an aesthetic point of view. Mm-hmm. Yards were used for utilitarian purposes. For example, people micro-farmed their property in urban areas, especially working-class people. And this was true, by the way, up even through into the 1930s. You had people growing gardens in their mm-hmm. in their yards, even in their front yards, mm-hmm. and also raising geese and
chickens,
chickens and rabbits and so forth. So essentially the yard was a way of putting food on the table. Mm-hmm. It's really only in the post-World War II period that the idea of a perfect lawn, a weed-free, super green, ultra-trim expanse is invented mm-hmm. here in the United States. And that has to do with a set of forces that are unique to the 1950s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Well, who had the first lawns in America to begin with before? Because, I mean, I always had the notion that it was kind of an elitist thing initially because it was pretty labor intensive. So how is it that it was elitist and then now today everybody has one?
Right. Well, that's a good question. I mean, lawn goes way back in American history. Washington and Jefferson had lawns, and you're entirely correct. I mean, the American lawn is in a way of imitating what was going on over in Britain. Mm-hmm. The big difference, of course, is that in Britain, it's easy, relatively easy, to grow cool season turfgrass species like Kentucky bluegrass.
Right.
Trying to do that here, however, in North America is an uphill ecological battle, unless you happen to live in Newfoundland, where they, in fact, have a little town, I believe, that's named Lawn.
Really?
It had what was essentially a conceit on the part of the upper classes become something that everybody has and everybody's dealing with on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. Well, that has a lot to do, first of all, with the development of the rotary power mower, which was developed in the 1930s. This was a real lawnmower.
R-E-E-L, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
These mowers are, they're expensive to produce, and it wasn't until the development of the rotary power mower that American manufacturers figured out a way to allow Americans to cut the grass with a machine that could be produced inexpensively and that could be available to people. And we now find it, of course, in garages all across the United States.
Right.
There's something on the order of about 38 to 40 million power lawnmowers here in the U.S. today.
And then the spread of the lawns in America, I've always wondered if it was the chicken-egg thing. What came first, Scott's Seed Company or the need to have a better lawn or both?
The Scott's Company goes way back.
Yeah.
The Scott's Company provided seed for agriculture, but didn't really get into the lawn end of the of its business until the early part of the 20th century, where it first began providing premium grass seed to golf courses. That was, I believe, in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, the Scott's Company engaged in some very, very savvy marketing. For example, they produced, I believe, in 1928, the first guide to taking care of a lawn. It was something called Lawn Care. It was a lawn care magazine, essentially.
And it was an important development because taking care of a lawn doesn't come naturally. need some advice. And and the Scotts Company was really very brilliant marketers figured out that people were never going to be able to buy their products if they didn't know what they were supposed to be doing with them. So they provided free of charge, essentially, the information that people needed. And I think this was very important development.
So ironically, we're all sheep.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Well put. So, Ted, did the growing interest in golf and the ability to pursue more leisure activities contribute to the technologies that supported this whole lawn for every man?
Yeah, I mean, golf is important. Of course, the sport exploded in importance in the post-war period with President Eisenhower, who was an avid golfer. And, of course, during the post-war period, the gross national product nearly doubled between 1945 and 1961, and this created a very fluid situation from the standpoint of social mobility. And what people saw on the golf course, I think, influenced what they came to expect in terms of their lawns as well. You know, automatic irrigation systems, for example, which are now very common here where I live in Shaker Heights, Ohio. They began in the 60s, first on golf courses.
So then, as the subdivisions, as the spread, I mean, let's talk some more about the psyche, the modern psyche. And I think the fact that now both husband and wife work are a factor too, and this incredible growth of lawn care companies. That, can we ever get over this, keeping up with the Joneses lawn, or are we stuck with this, do you think?
Well, in some sense, I think we may be at a point here where we might be seeing some real changes. I guess what I'm trying to say is that the idea of a perfect lawn, at least, has entered a very vulnerable period in its history, and that has to do with a number of different forces that have come into play since the 90s. But going back, you mentioned lawn care companies. It's important to understand that, I mean, it used to be that taking care of the lawn was a pretty low-tech affair. I mean, we got out there with a mower, and, you know, we had my dad had one of these hand edgers. It's one of these, it looked like a medieval-looking device.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hack away the clumps. But it was done by hand. It was not a power machine, power tool in any way. This was the kind of task that, you know, you just palmed off on the kid in the family,
right.
sort of thing. Or you got the kid around the block to come bring his mower over and cut the grass for, you know, a few bucks or something
right.
like that.
And now we pay services.
Right. It's not really till the late 60s and certainly the 70s that we see what I call the industrialization of lawn care. And what's precipitating this, in part at least, is, well, two things. Mechanization, increased mechanization, for example, the invention of leaf blowers and weed whackers, and of course, cheap immigrant labor. And these two developments now have come together to precipitate a kind of industrial revolution, such that now everybody is, instead of just allowing the kid in the family to go out there and with a push mower, say, and run around in the backyard, as somebody they pay, you know, $30-$40 a week or something like that to not only mow their yard, but to groom it into absolute perfection.
Yeah, I'm always struck, like a Stephen King novel, I'll drive some of these upper-end subdivisions, and there's nobody out there but people on orange mowers.
Yeah.
And it's just empty, like they're all on the moon except the lawn care people, and the kids are inside playing video games or ballet lessons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's it's sad if it's true, but it might be true.
Yeah. Where did this psyche come from, I guess? What was that sociological training, American training, that makes us gripped with the perfect lawn?
Well, first of all, I should say, I don't think it's genetic.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an argument that's been made.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, not for perfect lawns, but for the lawn in general, the idea. And there's, of course, a bit of truth to this, the idea that human beings evolved on the savannas of Africa, and this love for open, grassy expanses is somehow imprinted on our genes.
Huh.
Well, anybody that's been to Africa, of course, knows that the grass there is neither short nor particularly green. So that may explain perhaps the lawn, but it certainly doesn't explain the idea of a perfect lawn, a super green, weed-free expanse like you see on these advertisements. So what explains that, the rise of this perfect lawn aesthetic, is complicated. But the short story is that a bunch of developments occur in the post-war period that I think are important here. One has to do with economic trends. During the post-war period, American manufacturers had figured out how to sell Americans all kinds of things. But what they had not figured out how to produce was the perfect consumer, somebody that was going to go back to the store repeatedly to buy things. Uh-huh. And this is where the idea of a perfect lawn fit in brilliantly. Perfect lawns are difficult to grow, as I said earlier. These are species that are exotic, they're non-native, it's an uphill ecological battle. And while this is bad news, of course, from the standpoint of the homeowner, it's music to the ears of those in the
business,
in the chemical lawn care business. So I like to say that the idea of a perfect lawn is the on-the-ground equivalent of planned obsolescence. Trying to have a perfect lawn is just—it's just really hard.
Uh-huh.
You're gonna one of these things. You're just going to be going back to the store over and over again, buying more things, more chemical inputs, and what have you, in the elusive quest for a perfect yard. Also, trends in brightly colored consumer products were all the rage in the 50s and especially the 1960s. Things like blue Jell-O.
Uh-huh.
And yellow slacks and hot pink cars and this kind of thing. And again, here, a super green, emerald green lawn fit in with this trend very, very well. The idea was that these brightly colored consumer products demonstrated that the consumer was a forward-looking, ultra-modern American who had forsaken the black and white world of urban life for the multicolored kaleidoscope of suburbia with its methyl green lawns.
Mm.
This, too, was important. So there are a set of historical developments here happening in the 50s and 60s coming together that I think help precipitate the emergence of the perfect turf aesthetic.
Are we doomed, you know, with $4 an gallon gasoline and worry about pollution and global warming? Are we doomed to this, or can we get over it?
Well, I think the idea of a perfect lawn has entered a very vulnerable period in its history. You rightly point out, the perfect lawn is predicated on two resources we're rapidly running short of, oil and water.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is a trend that's been going on since the 1990s, green consumerism.
Right.
And it doesn't really make sense to buy organic carrots in the morning at your your organic supermarket and go in the afternoon, dump a load of
2,4-D
on your lawn.
Yeah.
And thirdly, I think what we see happening here recently are trends in Canada, which are not widely reported here in the media in the U.S., but there's really a kind of anti-perfect lawn revolution going on in Canada and has been for some time now. Canadian municipalities, about 120 of them, have now passed ordinances that either restrict or ban the use, the cosmetic use, of lawn care pesticides.
Oh.
Quebec, last spring, put into effect the most stringent lawn care pesticide ban and ordinance in all of North America. And it's unquestionably the case that this trend, this anti-perfect lawn trend, has developed in Canada.
Down with perfect lawns.
Yeah, it's dipping south across the border.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of concern, of course, in the green industry that there's going to be activism on the part of Americans for similar sorts of ordinances.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there may not be a bad idea. Well, it's been interesting. We thank you for your time. And
yes, sir.
I certainly like the idea of the non-perfect lawn movement. Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Ted.
Thanks for having me.
Ted Steinberg is an environmental historian at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and the author of several books, including American Green, The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Lawn. Of course, if you'd like more information on Ted Steinberg and American Green, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's fabulous plant stories. You're listening to Homegrown at 89.3 WFPL.
The old hometown looks the same as I step down from the train. And there to meet me is my mama. and Papa. Down the road I look, and there runs Mary, hair of gold and lips like cherries. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home. Yes, they'll all come to meet me, arms reaching, smiling sweetly. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill with some questions for Janine Wishy.
All right.
At least
a question
one.
For you too, mister.
Uh-oh. In my face, huh?
Yeah. Right back at you.
Okay. This one's from Kathleen and JT.
Okay.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah, I do too.
Kathleen and JT. Thanks for thinking of us. Dear Janine and Bob, we have loads of mature, flat leaf parsley in our container bed, but we've noticed most leaves are discolored with a yellowish or white coloring. I found this online. Septoria leaf spot is caused by the fungus Septoria apicola.
She's done her research, huh?
Yeah, way ahead of us. Which is the most common disease of parsley. Because it is seed-borne, it's important to purchase quality seed. Here's her question, really. Is this parsley going to be safe to eat? Mm-hmm. She wasn't sure if she could eat it, knowing mm-hmm. it's got this disease.
Mm-hmm.
What's your feeling on that?
I have the same problem, but what I actually suspect it might be, because she says the yellow and kind of whitish,
right.
kind of mottling, speckling, speckled, it might be flea beetles. Flea beetles really like parsley as well. So if she wants to know for sure, inspect the plant a little more closely.
For holes?
And, well, they don't always, they will do holes,
okay.
but they don't always do holes.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Sometimes they just, like, suck.
The insidious flea beetle.
Yeah. And if she looks at the plant really closely, she'll see some flea beetles. They're teeny, little, shiny black, kind of look like fleas, but tiny, shiny black little things that hop really quick. If you know what I mean? Thus the flea connotation.
But you don't want meat with your leaf parsley, I'm assuming.
I wash and eat my flat leaf parsley, even though it's not perfect looking. And even if it's Septoria.
Apicola,
thank you. You can still wash it and eat it. You know, taste it, make sure that it's got the taste that you want, but it's not going to, be harmful to you.
And I'm assuming you're leaving the flea beetles outside.
Right. And something that does work on flea beetles, Bob, that's a botanical insecticide, is the rootinone. That will work on flea beetles.
Okay.
So I wouldn't personally put it on parsley just because it's a leafy thing that you're going to use as mm-hmm. your food thing. But if you really want to, you can.
Bottom line, you think it's safe to eat?
Absolutely.
Just wash it really good.
Just wash it normal and it's fine.
We hope to hear from you again in the future.
Exactly. No, I eat it. I just made some tomato soup and put a whole bunch of flat-leaf parsley in it.
And you look marvelous, young
and
lady.
And I'm still alive.
So you're doing fine.
Okay.
Any questions for Bob, maybe?
Indeed. This one is from Henry, and it involves crepe myrtle, Bob.
Yep.
They've recently planted 3 different varieties of crepe myrtle, and they've been mindful of keeping them watered,
mm-hmm.
but they have some concerns about what their long-term, plan of action should be taking care of these 3 crepe myrtles.
Actually, they're pretty easy to take care of. It's interesting. 10, 15 years ago, you couldn't find as many, but
mm-hmm.
thank God for global warming, huh?
Yeah. And the National Arboretum introductions.
Yeah, they have hardy, hardy cultivars. They really do. But basically, they're real easy to grow. They need like full sun. They'll take almost any kind of soil. They like a lot of water to get started, like most plants.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll bloom on new growth.
But then once they're established, they're really drought tolerant.
You're on, yeah.
Yeah.
And they recommend you can prune them because they bloom on new growth, but they recommend unless they die to the ground in a heavy winter, it's not always good to cut them all the way to the ground because the flower so heavily that they'll fall over.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't look as good. And really, I like a good upright crepe myrtle,
mm-hmm.
In its place.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them a little gaudy for me, but there's a lot of nicer, more muted tones. I've got 2 or 3 dwarf cultivars I really like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, mounding little bush about 3 or 4 feet tall and nice little pink, rosy flowers on them.
Mm-hmm.
Great plant.
Yeah,
I like
great
that plant.
But, all in all, once they're established, they're extremely low maintenance And I don't think, you know, if you've got decent soil, that don't even require any extra fertilization or anything like that, you know. Mulch with some good composted material, and that should do the trick.
And keep your pruners sharp.
Keep your pruners sharp. There you go.
Yes, sir.
All right.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246.
Well, Bob, what do you have for the plant story this week?
It's innocent, it's virginal, it's the chaste tree.
Ah, the vitex.
I've always wondered about it, really.
Yeah.
It's another one of those, God help us, little yew shrubs. We say this about once a week about some plant, but it's true.
Speaking of crepe myrtles, from the question earlier, the vitex sort of is in that category of, you know, the southern plant.
Right.
If you go to South Carolina, you see humongous vitexes.
And actually, you'll see actual trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had it for years. I kind of grow up my shrub border. It's borderline hardy here, but it comes back every year from the ground. The neat thing about it is late summer, early fall, it's got these delicate-looking, spiky, lavender-blue flowers.
Mm-hmm.
They're just really pretty, 8 to 10 inches long. It's got nice green leaves. It's kind of a tall, open shrub. It can be a tree if properly pruned, but it's worth having. If you got any kind of space at all in your yard, think about the vitex or the chaste tree. The best varieties...
Very aromatic, too.
Yeah,
yeah.
I like to touch it.
Mm-hmm.
The best varieties are the latifolia, and there's also a white and a pink. I've never seen a pink. I'd love to see one, yeah. But the Latin name, of course, is Vitex agnus castus. And vitex means bendable or pliant.
Huh.
We used to use it to build fences.
Huh.
And the agnus castus is chaste lamb.
Huh.
And I'll get to that later because it's very interesting. It's a native of the Western Asia, Mediterranean Sea area. It's got a great history. It goes back 2,500 years. In the ancient Greek festivals, the women, the chaste women, wore its blossoms.
Okay.
It had to be chaste.
So there it is.
In Rome, the Vestal Virgins paraded around with them.
Uh-huh. Those of course.
I didn't realize. I looked up Vestal Virgins, and they had an interesting life. They
were
way ahead of the game as far as women. They could own property. They guarded the sacred fires. They kept wills. All they had to do in return was stay virgins for 30 years.
Yeah. Only 30 years?
Yeah.
So not forever.
They picked them out.
That's
but
good.
Most of them hung on to that once they got
okay.
that far because they understood the keys to the castle right
there. I gotcha.
And here's the thing. If they gave in to temptation any time in that 30 years, they were buried alive with a few days of food.
Huh.
So hence the chaste tree helped them out. And of course, the monks, this was cool too, new monks entering the monastery had chaste flowers strewn on their path.
Mm-hmm.
And they ate seeds called monk's pepper, which was an anti-aphrodisiac, they thought. So the poor monks had to eat pepper from the chaste tree to resist the desires of the flesh.
Huh.
Had all sorts of other uses, including the cure of flatulence.
That could be an anti-aphrodisiac, too.
That's exactly. You got my line there, yeah. And it did help women regulate their monthly cycles. It was used for that. And actually, what's amazing, there's some evidence, modern chemistry has indicated it actually did do those things.
Cool.
Everything it was supposed to have said to have done, particularly with women, it did.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's a poem that comes with this.
Of course.
It's an ode to all Vestal virgins and the occasional wayward monk. As we look back over two millennia or more, when the Greeks of their virgins did keep score, and the monks trod flowers at the monastery door, don't you wonder at the power of such lore? To keep us so wrapped in mystery, those lavender flowers of just one tree, they live on today in history, ever chaste, ever pure, ever conscience-free. In our age of Viagra and great expectations, and warnings about five-hour erections, that the Greeks could solve such predilections with pepper seeds as their only protections. There you go.
Oh,
the chaste tree.
You're much better than any old commercial on television. Very
good. The five-hour erection. I always wonder what little kids think when they see that. Dad.
Or blurred vision.
Yeah. Mom, Dad, what's a five-hour erection?
Okay.
That's the chase tree, folks.
All right. Sounds good. We may all need it someday.
Right.
But for now, this ends another edition of Homegrown
next week
on the show. Returning nature to its natural state in English Meadow and a return to the savannah at Iroquois Park's Summit Field.
Homegrown is produced by the always ornamental Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. Our website is maintained by onion lover Alice Thompson. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.